It was intended for the human to support the machine to support the human at work.
And AI means something different to anybody you talk to, which is wild.
This is AI or Die.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to AI or Die. I believe we're at episode 16. I can't believe we've been doing this for over a year at this point. It's kind of cool. Hey, Reagan. Hey, Brendan. How you guys doing? Welcome back. Good to see you guys.
Good.
Doing good. Doing good.
I make sure to make the titles of these, of the links to join as the episode number just for you, Nick.
I don't know why I have this weird obsession with episode number. I keep like reaching for things to talk about. I'm like episode 10, episode 16. We'll have a big bash for episode 20. That'll be a big one. Episode 50, eventually someday too. Yeah.
We need to do seasons too. We need to give you an extra thing to keep track of.
Remember.
So, welcome to season 9, episode 27.
Are we still in season 1? I mean, I think that's worth talking about. Is this still technically season 1? Would you guys call this season 2 of AI or Die?
Why do they need seasons? Like, what does seasons add for a podcast? I don't know.
There should be a break. I think that's like we take a summer break or a winter break, and like we do a season finale, and then we come back and do like a reunion show, and then an after the show talk and all that too.
Yeah, do like a cliffhanger at the end of the season. You know. Like, uh-oh, Brendan, yeah, like might have died on the last episode. You gotta tune in next season to find out if he made it.
Yeah, you gotta tune in. Yeah, I like that. But personally, what's been new with you guys? I just got back from, I went with some family. We went to Napa. My sister-in-law is actually, she runs a data and analytics company for wineries. So it's kind of cool talking to her just about vineyard intelligence and things like farm planning. Like a lot of these old family wineries are so antiquated in terms of how they manage their operations. Like, yeah, no pun intended, like very ripe for disruption in terms of data and analytics.
Nice.
For winery intelligence and all that too.
That was a good one. What was the most surprising use of data that you observed?
A big thing is the rainfall. Anytime they talk about like a specific year of wine, like 2017, like a big thing is like, were there fires? So smoke impacted. And then ultimately the rainfall on the specific hillside that those grapes were grown on. So the amount of time it seems like they spend on just understanding how many droplets of water like hit the vine, what time of day, how much rainfall, and all of that having downstream effects on the flavor profile and everything else too. Just how that minute detail, it can influence the price of a bottle of wine being $6,000 versus like $600. It's insane. Yeah.
That is wild. And so I assume when people reference back to the year, they know those details about what happened in that year.
Yeah. Is it like a longstanding, is that vine 50 years old? In 2017, there was a fire that smoke blew on the hillside, and now that's why it has a specific flavor, like so, so deep as a hobby. Yeah.
Wildfire cool. Flavor.
Yeah. Yes. Very ashy, oaky. Yeah. So it was fun to learn about that. Obviously being in Napa is beautiful too. So after that though, I feel like that was the last kind of like summer thing I'm doing. Now it's kind of like back to school. Summer's over. To say it. What's new with you guys though? Reagan, what's new in your life? What's going on personally?
My husband and I just bought a house, so we're pretty pumped about that.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, we're sticking around in Ohio for a little bit longer. Yeah, pretty excited about that. So that's kind of a big piece of my personal life. Also, we just had the Data Connect conference, which I know is work related, but is also very personal to me.
Yeah.
Folks that don't know what that is, it's a large global conference in Ohio. We have about 60 speakers every year, about 1,200 attendees. All of our speakers are women or gender minority individuals. And we cover topics on data, AI, and analytics. And it was super fun. It feels like a giant family reunion every time I'm there because so many people come back year after year and we bring in people from all over the world. So it's really nice. Good excuse to get in front of some folks that might be harder to get to or see or catch up with. So it was great. I had so much fun. I'm always very exhausted afterwards because I'm just an introvert. So having to talk to people for like 2 days or 3 days straight, it's a lot.
Yeah, and you emceed this year as well too. So you're talking on stage and off stage, connect with folks. It's a lot.
Yeah, I actually felt like that was more chill. I know that sounds weird, but like you're sitting backstage the whole time. You're watching the entire show from the screens on in the backstage. So I actually get to enjoy all the talks on the main stage. And, you know, I get to drum up some annoying Reagan humor while I'm back there.
You're just back there riffing like, okay, I'm going to try this. Nice.
I said the silliest things on stage this year.
Just let it fly. Who knows? Yeah, that's fun. That's fun. So how many years is that now? What is that, the seventh year of Data Connect now?
Yeah, this is our seventh conference. We also do the West Coast one. So technically this was our ninth event, but yeah, cool. In Columbus, it was our seventh.
Nice. Well, congrats.
It's a first grader, you know, like it's like.
Yeah, man, it's an annoying toddler at this point. For sure.
I'm kicking myself. If I was in town for it, we could have done like a live podcast recording there or something like that. We'll have to do
another one. That would be cool.
That was really fun whenever we did that back on like episode 8 or something like that. Like a live.
You had to go and drink wine in Napa.
I know. Yeah. You know, duty calls. Yeah, I had to do it. Yeah. What's up, B? What's new with you, man? How's it going?
I'm back in Colorado, so it's exciting. Wow. Yeah. I got up to Boulder this weekend, hanging out with family and stuff, but I moved to Barcelona about a year ago, so it's interesting to come back like a year later. Things are already different, so it's kind of cool, but it's just nice being back up in the mountains, seeing everybody, and then I'm also doing a talk like AI and product on Thursday, which is very exciting. It's at like a Boulder startup event community thing, so it's nice kind of full circle because I worked at a Boulder startup doing, I was thinking about this the other day, it's like computer vision, like OCR stuff for bank checks in college. So it's kind of cool to come back like 10 years later and be doing a talk like that in that kind of community. So very excited for it.
You may see some familiar faces there too, because before you left, you were pretty busy in the product community at Denver. Colorado.
Yeah, there's actually a really strong, just to plug in case anybody's in the Colorado area, but Colorado Product is like one of the best professional networking groups I've ever personally been involved with. Three of my really good advisors and mentors are out of that. So it's been a fantastic community to like people that are very knowledgeable and just very like approachable. I think it's one of those cool things about both the Colorado startup scene and the Austin tech startup scene as well. We're both just so many very intelligent, very capable folks that are very approachable, where I think that would be harder to do on the coast. So I feel like they're very welcoming, kind of like very easy for people who are moving up in their careers to kind of find folks to work with. So it's been great.
Nice. Good updates, guys. And then from Line A overall, we're having more and more users on the platform from an enterprise standpoint as well. So growth mode is happening. It is very exciting times at Line A at a high
level.
It
is happening. More and more enterprises, large ones, you know, sorting through all the fun challenges that come with onboarding really big companies.
Yeah.
But it's great.
It is great. And it's so cool seeing across these different variation of industries and like company sizes, just the similar patterns of what they're working on and ultimately how they're trying to influence their people to think about AI differently and data differently at their work too. So very fun.
Yeah. We're noticing this new pattern too, just to kind of call it out, is the AI COE and supporting them with our platform. And the reason I bring this up is Noelle Russell and I did a fun fireside chat at Data Connect about AI COEs, and I'll post the recording to that once we get the edited versions back. But she was talking about how every AI project starts as a baby tiger. It's so cute and everybody likes it. And then, you know, eventually it gets teeth and claws and it gets hard and you try to get into production and you try to think about all the risks associated with it. And it was kind of funny, but the AI COE support work that we're doing, I think, is really amazing. Honestly, it's across industries. We've developed an AI expert committee that our customers get access to in cyber, in legal, in Gen AI architecture, in data architecture, in workforce development and transformation. So I'm pretty excited about that offering and solution that we've got bundled with our platform. And it seems to be really resonating with folks, like really just getting those policies and procedures documented, but not just that, it's like turning that into action. How do we actually onboard new vendors? How do we evaluate new vendors that have AI capabilities? How do we ensure that people know how to use it? How do we ensure people are using it the right way? How do we kind of feed off of that as more and more people are leveraging these tools across the organization? Do we build? Do we buy? How do we assess that? How do we actually curate use cases? I have not seen a lot of well-curated use cases at companies. I see giant lists of like 400, you know, rows on an Excel sheet, but like, how do you really sort through that and like understand exactly what it is? Like, we can't just say documentation search. That's too broad. What does that mean? What kinds of documents? What are you searching on? You know? So I think that's been really interesting and really fun because we also get to see all the different trends that these different industries have and what sorts of use cases they're coming up with as well.
Yeah, that's really emerging as an operational tactic within like how to deploy AI at scale, this AI COE getting stood up and like this cross-functional team finally getting formalized inside of these organizations. Legal, procurement, the technical teams, just like everybody who has a shared stake in reviewing use cases and getting them approved as well. Finally, having a place to do that is really cool.
Yeah, and I also like to, we've been working with a very large automotive COE, and I like how they're approaching it too on the governance side, because it's less of like the traffic cop or like the enforcing of policies, like kind of more of an IT or PMO kind of stance, but they're really looking to like enable and encourage like collaboration and alignment with the business, which I think is really great. Cause it's like part educational, like, hey, here's the best way to run a data science project. And then it's also building in the gates that are not just, you know, arbitrary reviews, but more of like, hey, make sure you review this with the business, right? Like, make sure you go to the business and talk through these aspects, because that's what's really important to get alignment at this stage of the project. So I think it's really interesting to see how they're approaching it less from like a, let's prepare to make sure we don't get audited kind of perspective, and more of like a, hey, let's make sure we run these projects the best way, and the best way being that heavy collaboration with the business.
Yeah, I've been hammering that point, actually. There's a lot of organizations out there that are approaching this very much from a regulation and auditability perspective, and I get it. That is obviously a route to take. However, there's not a lot of regulation that's really coming down on a lot of companies right now. You know, it's still being sorted through. Obviously, you have the EU AI Act, and you've got some of the stuff in the US preliminary discussions, and some of the state level legislation, which I know maybe we'll talk about a little bit today. But, you know, I think we are approaching it very much from a value perspective. Like, how do we justify all of this spend on AI, which is actually a huge headline right now in the news? You see all of these companies getting more and more funding, tons and tons, like hundreds of millions of dollars in funding. And the big question is, where's the revenue? Where's the payoff? You know, sometimes there's billions of dollars of funding in this AI boom, and everyone's kind of searching around for where that payoff is. And so far, it's not there. And I get that it takes a while, right? There's a decent time horizon on that. But I wonder if it's worth all of the capital being poured into this area right now.
And when that will start to flip, if it already has, with kind of this whole hype cycle and the path that it typically follows over time. And ultimately, what do enterprises do about it at the end of the day as well? Like, ultimately, they have, especially in the financial industry, regulators to address, like risk reduction is definitely a key focus. But what are the other aspects that they need to bring in to these COEs for sure?
Right. Like, we are sitting on the front line of value for a lot of these products inside of enterprises, because we help with enablement. And I mean, some of the claims that these companies are making on how much money they're saving companies with their AI tools, I just have a really hard time believing that, because we're not seeing that level of scalable value right at the moment. I think there's potential there, so I don't want to like underplay it too much, but it's not there yet. And so when I hear those numbers, I think, wow, you grabbed a really specific edge case where you probably put a lot of bodies on that use case, and you made sure it got used, adopted, rolled out, and leveraged, and you showed value. But that is not common. So like, when you hear those numbers, they're giving you the highest ROI use case that they've observed over tons and tons of implementations. And then they're saying like, this is how much it's going to save you. And you're like, yeah, but that's like, that's an anomaly. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's also like talking to folks that have been successful with it. Like, they're like, you need to have a portfolio of projects. Like, it's like a power law thing. It's like a product. It's not like a, you know, small OpEx project that's going to return 2x or whatever. Like, half the time, it's going to be like 1 out of 10, it will return 10x or more, or whatever that is, right? So I think that's something interesting for teams to keep an eye on, is that they need to have that large volume of use cases so they can run multiple in project, like in parallel, and see which projects are going to be the ultimate kind of like big ticket winners, and making sure they have enough of those in the portfolio. Cause if you do one or two, you're probably not going to find it, right? So you really need to like have multiple ones that you're pursuing. Not all 10 go to production, of course. They'll get axed along the way, if you will, or be unsuccessful along the way. But I think just having that enough volume going through that funnel is very key.
Well, yeah,
I was just going to say, I think like the build versus buy is also very important to call out here too. We're talking about building and how much money is dumped into that. But like on the buy side, I think what's interesting is we're seeing this kind of like Uber situation, right? Where they didn't have to be profitable. They were super well-funded pre-IPO. They could charge very little and provide a lot of value to their riders and still pay, in some cases, in points in time for that company, pay their drivers decent wages. And so, but then they, you know, reality hit once they IPO'd. And so they're trying to course correct. Now they're charging a ton because it was not a profitable scenario. And so for the buy side, I think it's just really important to keep that in mind because a lot of these companies are really well funded. And so they can charge less, you know, they can charge something that's not going to be profitable today because they're trying to identify patterns that might be super profitable. So they can charge more. So just keep that in mind as a consumer or as an enterprise leader when you're buying these tools. Eventually, they will need to become profitable. And so if they can't find that profitability in some of these use cases, they're either going to hike that price up or that company's going to go away. And so there's always this risk associated with the buy side as well. It may seem cheaper right now, but that might just be temporary.
And working with these teams too, I'm still not seeing a vendor come with adequate value tracking for that ROI, the value that's provided through any of these vendor bot solutions as well, even the really big ones, right? You would expect there'd be a lot more built out to support the end user and the enterprise to understand where is the value we're getting out of our operations from leveraging this tool that we bought or built to? It's just super manual today.
For sure. I know that we just saw in the news too that Cohere just raised another $500 million to support. I actually like Cohere. I'm a big fan of Cohere. I think what they're doing is really neat. They're building out a platform for enterprises, which is what is needed. It's interesting to see them competing against some of the other big platforms as well. And they, it seems like they also have a lab in which they're building models that they make available to enterprises as well. I think this could be a really good opportunity for enterprises, not to plug them. I have no affiliation with them whatsoever, but I really do think it could be a good opportunity to get quick start and get all of the components that you need and initially to start building out some of these generative AI solutions internally that are a little bit more custom to you. And the reason I say that is like, we saw this evolution back in the day, quote unquote, right? Of this like first AI hype cycle where like SaaS was that end-to-end platform. Like you didn't have to think about it. You didn't have to think about the security element. You didn't have to think about the infrastructure. You didn't have to think about data connectivity. You know, they take care of all that for you. Environmental dependencies. Now, eventually open source caught up and the value of open source was much greater. And so it's interesting to watch Cohere kind of trying to do both, right? Like trying to also build some of the those components and then provide that flexible platform for enterprises. So I think what they're doing is really neat.
Yeah.
And they got revenue to back it. I think I saw $35 million in revenue is where they're at now, which I think was over double from this time last year.
Mm-hmm. And their approach is cool. It's cloud agnostic. Like it seems like they really make it easy for enterprises to start to adopt it as well. So yeah, best of luck. Yeah.
I think it's kind of interesting to see too, like where the different LLM providers or different like modeling approaches are like kind of starting to set themselves up in the market. Cause like OpenAI seems to be very heavily like, well, the ChatGPT version is very consumer facing. And then of course, Azure's OpenAI offering is like the default. And then I'm seeing Claude add, introduce a lot of like workflow development tools for like prompt engineering and things like that. So people have been raving about Claude recently. So I think like what their new model's doing is like really powerful for specific use cases. Like we're actually evaluating like Cohere versus Mistral versus like Claude right now for some use cases. And it's cool to see how they approach things and how they handle prompts differently. I think you're seeing more variation between models, it looks like, compared to where we were like even 6 months ago, let alone a year. So it's interesting to see how people are leveraging or like providing AI and like where they're focusing on like the value that they add for each of the different enterprises that they work with.
Yeah, that study we're doing is super insightful because even understanding the variation that even ChatGPT and OpenAI has with the prompt variation of input versus output you get versus the other models too, just from a user experience standpoint, it's fascinating. Yeah, they're not all created equal, that's for sure. So with that, let's get into the news. I know just in a few minutes, because our guest is going to join soon, we're excited for Kathy Koontz to hop on. Huge, huge, huge news was that outage that happened last week. And I think there is still reverberating effects around. My wife was in the airport yesterday coming back from LA, and somebody came over the PA and they're like, hey, if you were on this United flight, all the bags are still at the old airport. They never got onto the plane and like followed the plane to actually get to your destination. So there's still delays that are happening, especially in airlines related to that outage that happened. But what are your guys' reactions to it? I thought it was super interesting just how a single update pushed out could have such a widespread impact across the world.
Yeah, I was actually flying while it was all happening, and I don't know why, but my flight in was not delayed and my connecting flight wasn't concerned, like didn't have any issues. But I just see people running around DFW because I flew through Dallas and people were just like sprinting around and like arguing with gate agent. Like everybody was just having like a really bad time, but somehow it like missed me entirely, which I'm very grateful for. But no, I think it's like we are fractional CTO, Jason, me and him were talking about it because we're like, it didn't affect us because we run, like it affected Windows machines and we run like Linux and other stuff. So we didn't get impacted, but it was just interesting. Like there should be so much more QA that goes into that large of a thing. And it was also such a bad bug that it was like making the, like the blue screen. And then also they're trying to stand back up and they couldn't. So people couldn't even like log in to fix a lot of the machines. So just a really bad mess. And I think like someone's probably having a really bad time right now inside of CloudStrike. There's probably going to be some firings because apparently they had another issue like a month ago with a similar type of outage that was less public and less impactful, but was still a pretty bad issue like this as well. So hopefully they're fixing their stuff now.
Goes to show, you got to have standards. Rigorous testing process. You know, obviously this is, it's software, which is a little bit different than these AI systems. But I think this is that, like, I don't know if you guys have ever read the book Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill, but they, I think I probably mentioned it on this podcast before. I just think the book is great. But her point is that on a very small scale, you know, these things don't do a lot of damage. It's actually the baby tiger thing I was just talking about with Noelle, right? Like on a very small scale, it's like cute and whatever. And so that's where a lot of these companies are with their AI tools as well, or their AI systems that they're building. But as you start to scale it up and create this mass dependency, which is something we've talked about before, the shift to depend on the system, then you start actually seeing the risks. So right now we're talking about augmentation. Oh, it's just like helping me with this thing. I'm not depending on it and letting it run and do its own thing, like an agent system where it's autonomous and it has the agency to actually execute and communicate with other agents in the system. Like that's when you start getting to the point where you have to have insane amounts of oversight and governance and, you know, this proactive approach of trying to test and make sure that there's nothing going to go wrong. But yeah, it's a little bit, it's funny because it's related, but not, it's a little bit of a wake up call for everyone. Like, do we have our shit together? You know?
Right. Because I think we all look at it and we see that the future being work, having enterprise operationally dependent on a lot of these AI systems for that. So like, when does that flip start to happen? And what's going to be that first kind of widespread thing just like this, but associated to an AI system that a lot of companies depend on as well? I think it's interesting.
The flash crash. I'm doing this. I'm not sure if you, I can't remember what year this was, but there was like a robo trader. They deployed the wrong version of a model and it caused like a big flash crash. I think it bankrupted a firm. I'm actually researching this right now for that talk on Thursday, but I think there's already been those impacts. It's like an expert system and not like a proper like neural net or something, I think was the model running behind it, but it did cause like a very temporary crash of this the stock market. So I think it's interesting to see like where there's already been precedent for what bad AI can do when it goes wrong, you know?
All right. Welcome, Kathy. I'm so excited to have you on this podcast episode. I've known Kathy for such a long time.
Way back.
Almost, I know, almost my whole career, actually. Kathy's a mentor for me and has been actually a pretty big influence in my career. And we were talking about Data Connect and women in analytics, and you know, you were there from the beginning.
Loved it. It was so inspired to see your vision and just how far it's gone. And
it's crazy.
Rock on, Reagan.
Thank you. From a faculty club at Ohio State to the Hyatt downtown with 1,200 people, it has been quite the journey, and I'm glad you've been there for the ride. So it is my pleasure to have you on. I'm very excited to chat with you. You're absolutely brilliant. So you're definitely going to drop some great knowledge while we're here. Kathy's got an incredible background in data and also from an enterprise perspective. So she's currently at AWS, but she's also been at Nationwide, Teradata, Wells Fargo. And I think the thing that I've heard you talk about most importantly is kind of this idea of like governance and tying all of these core elements together. So I think you have a really good way of framing that up for organizations to think about, what does decentralized governance look like? How do we do this practically? How do we incorporate all of our data core fundamentals and practices into what we're doing now? And really even thinking about a lot of that change management element of AI and how do organizations actually adopt and get value. We'll dive into each of those topics during this discussion, but why don't you give us a quick background on yourself and then we'll jump right in.
Yeah, great. Great to see you again, Reagan. Meet everybody else. So yeah, as you said, I'm with AWS. I'm part of a global team that works with our customers to help them overcome the barriers that they encounter as they look to create sustainable competitive advantage from their data at scale. And oftentimes what we find and what, you know, studies show year after year is it's not the technology, it's the people, it's the process. You know, I work with so many organizations that may have a lot of their data and their analytics in the cloud, but they're still managing it with the skill sets and the processes that worked when they were on-prem. And so that lack of change really undermines the inherent value of moving to the cloud and slows down the promise of innovation that, you know, analytics and AI delivers. And so, you know, see a lot of ways that organizations tend to get in their own way when it comes to really solving those substantive business problems and creating that real financial value that so many of the management consulting firms are touting that Gen AI is going to deliver, but they don't really have the people process, and then sometimes the technology in place that's required to be able to achieve that.
Yeah, I love that you say that. I know we're like beating the same drum here, but I think what's wild is if people and process weren't the problem, then we would have it solved because the technology is advancing and it is so advanced. So like, if that were the solution, why isn't it working everywhere?
Yeah, and you know, as I tell customers, you know, the great thing about technology is it does what you tell it to do, right? If it's not doing what you want, then you just figure out how you gave it the wrong instructions. Not so with human beings, right? And so that change management is critical. And I think what I see is a lot of organizations have not done the change management to be able to access, understand, and create data products at scale broadly at the pace of innovation that they need, right? Too many organizations are still centralized. You have to go through a central team to get access to data. Their metadata is very technically driven and not business driven. The business owners who are creating that data don't have a sense of ownership and are not held accountable for the quality and reusability of that data. And so those sorts of aspects really get in the way of even more advanced predictive analytics, much less AI. And then you layer in, you know, from a data perspective, some of the technology that AI has introduced is barriers or challenges is so many organizations have looked at analytics purely as descriptive analytics. We have all these dashboards and we can slice and dice and, you know, I can build my own dashboards and that's great, but that, you know, that's pretty low on the analytic maturity scale. And the dashboards generally require, you know, fairly large volumes of structured data that is highly conformed and designed for that descriptive analytic purpose. Generative AI is powered really more by your unstructured data with some structured data, you know, necessary for certain aspects of it. But that lack of attention over the last, you know, really since the beginning of the big data movement on unstructured data, understanding what is in that data, understanding what quality unstructured data looks like, and what unstructured data is a accurate representation of a successful outcome of a business process has really put organizations at a disadvantage to take advantage of AI beyond, you know, a few random POCs.
For sure. I think when you talk about that too, like sometimes organizations have a hard time wrapping their heads around what that unstructured data is. Mm-hmm. Because to your point, they've not, it's not in this nice kind of column row, you know, relational database form, tabular form, Excel sheet form. And so I guess from your lens, what have been the major phases of unstructured data over the course of the last decade? And where are we at now? And how should companies be thinking about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of unstructured data were previously has been used for what I've seen as two primary use cases, right? Is, you know, call center analytics, customer sentiment, right? And fraud analytics, right? Trying to tease out where there may be fraudulent activity in unstructured data. But thinking about a large corpus of unstructured data that can be used to refine a large language model, right? So let's take the use case of I am a medical equipment imaging manufacturer, right? And I have a lot of different machines with a lot of different configurations in a lot of different operating environments. And I have field techs all over the place. And I want my field techs to be able to understand, to be able to ask questions and not have to dig through, you know, a 40-page PDF to find that one paragraph they want that solves that problem, or even, you know, something that's not in that manual PDF that was a side note that some more advanced field tech typed in, entered into his resolution of an open ticket. I want them to be able to find that easily, right? So understanding here was the problem as described in the unstructured text when it was submitted. Finding those tickets that led to successful outcomes, either time to resolve, customer sentiment, cost for the organization to resolve, and then gathering that data together and using that to refine a large language model so that it understands the nuances of medical imaging equipment repair and what is specific about our machines. Right. That's where that corpus of unstructured data is still buried out in, you know, shared drives, you know, on somebody's PDF, on somebody's, you know, network. And so being able to find that, access that, point the model at the unstructured data that's successful, i.e. not the one that got in a loop and couldn't get solved and they chased down 15 paths before they got to the one that was right. Right. That's where, you know, organizations really need to be spending their time on their unstructured data to get the large language models that are already in place aware of their context, their operating environment, and really be able to take distributed workers, whether it's field techs, salespeople, you know, manufacturing operators, supply chain buyers, right? Surface up that information that they need in a rapid conversational way and make sure that they're looking at the right piece of information given the context of their problem.
Yeah, and to your prior point, the process being so convoluted in that way, but also enterprises really struggling to define who does these different steps in the process to serve this information, but also consider the who on the user side, that variation of folks on the floor versus folks in the marketing team who we need to serve and basically understand their workflows, essentially, to be able to be integrated into their work easily as well. We find it's a significant struggle. I'm sure you're seeing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Which, you know, points to, I think, one of the core challenges is that so many organizations are, again, approaching this as a technology initiative or even an analytic initiative, right? You've got to start with the, you know, air quote, customer of that AI insight, right? What is their decision-making process? What is their operating environment? What is their personality like? Are they big picture thinkers? Are they quick on their feet? Are they averse to technology? Are they comfortable using mobile technology? All of those things where, you know, you start with the customer, and that's Amazon's methodology, right? Start with the customer. work backwards to solve a real problem that they have and do it in a way that delights them, right? And then when you do that way, that you're A, solving a problem they know and want solved, which a lot of data AI teams miss, and then B, do it in a way that creates delight, that really helps almost eliminate a lot of the change management challenges that organizations face, because they, you know, the person who needs to use this to actually create that value, that last mile, they've been involved in its design. They know it's a problem they want solved. They can see how it's going to work within how they do their jobs. And you don't have to convince them to use it if you get those elements right.
Yeah, it's so fascinating too, because we often talk about the fact that these AI systems are either automating or augmenting existing tasks that people are doing today. I mean, that is the goal. So we talked about relational data, where we can find trends and then we can take that and we can match it up with our own personal context of being at the company for X number of years. And then we can go make a decision and that has an impact. And, you know, we get credited for that impact because we had the insight and we made the decision. And so we get a promotion because we saved X millions of dollars, right? And now we're introducing AI into this mix where we're saying AI is now going to augment some of that context. And it's going to match up with all of these other tools that you're leveraging. How do you think about that from a workforce perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the workforce, I mean, a lot of folks who are knowledge workers or individual contributors are reading a lot about AI is going to come and take your job. And so I think organizations need to be very cognizant of how they communicate with their teams. You know, the tech team, the data team, the analytics team, even the leadership may be really excited about AI, but you've got to understand the emotional state of the people who are going to be using it. And is this going to take my job? So it has to feel like this is augmenting my job and making it easier for me to do my job. I think the other thing that, you know, organizations need to talk about is less about the efficiency gains that they get, because when workers hear efficiency, they think layoffs. I'm not going to have a job because I'm going to be, you know, efficient out of my job. But if it is presented in a way that this is going to help you both better serve the needs of the customer and the company, you can. So think about supply chain, right? And a supply chain gets disrupted and I'm a buyer and I need to know which of these parts are going to be, you know, might have been going through the Suez Canal last year that are going to be rerouted. So they're going to be delayed. You know, with a robust supply chain AI enhanced system, I would have been able to just ask, you know, which parts are going to be delayed, what customers are impacted, and where are the non-Suez Canal suppliers who have parts priced at a similar level? And that is possible with Gen AI. Now, that's not necessarily, that does make the procurement specialist, you know, more efficient, but the big win is protecting the margin. So I don't have to just start calling around and I'm in a bit of a panic because I need to make sure that we meet our assurance of supply and we've got what we need in on the manufacturing line. I can get guidance from the AI of how I can meet that while protecting as much margin as possible. So I am driving customer satisfaction, I'm being more efficient, and I'm protecting the company's margin, which means more salaries, better bonuses for me and everybody I work with. And so just thinking about how to frame that as you look to roll it out and really being clear with the what's in it for me beyond efficiency and smarter decisions, I think is critical to allay some of the fears that seem so common in the marketplace now.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point because we work with one of our advisors who's high up at Ford, Mike Cavaretta, and he talked about you want to become like a trusted advisor, right? And you're not going to become a trusted advisor if you're like automating people's work and having layoffs for those business units. Like you want those business units to come with you, to come to you with those big problems. I think the tricky part is always that, like, in the beginning, you need to show tangible ROI, and time savings can be kind of the tangible ROI. So I'm just kind of curious how you've seen teams navigate that of, like, we want to show ROI up front to get to these higher level problems, but we kind of need to draw the line from, you know, or we need to prove our budget to finance to kind of get to that point of trusted advisor. So kind of curious what you've seen work there.
Yeah, I think, you know, using efficiency for that initial investment, that proof of concept, right? We have proved that this concept will work here and in its, you know, very nascent state can deliver some value. But I think having clarity and partnering with those business units to come up with a roadmap of, okay, once we have this in, how do we leverage the work that we've done here, take you to a new level, build out this capability in, let's say, 3-month sprints, where each one adds some sort of marginal value, but you have a really inspiring big vision of when we get there, after we have this period of 12 to 18 month investment, it's not just going to be efficiency, it's going to be this big chunk of revenue and margin. And that way, both finance sees the bigger numbers and is more willing to maybe take some early misses, as long, you know, maybe you didn't hit your efficiency numbers, but there's trust in those larger numbers. And the people who need to use those products to create that value are excited about that future state vision and understand it's not always just going to be about taking tasks away from them that could eventually, you know, cause them to be out of a job.
I love that. I think that's so great for building trust to say, like, hey, you're, like you mentioned, you're a part of this small product, but you're also part of this bigger roadmap of where we're going. So I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, one of the sessions at Data Connect, Akia Obas from Netlify had this session about ticketing systems is where, you know, analytics teams go to die. And she was talking about the value of that roadmap with your, you know, your business partners, right? And so if you think about that term you use, Brendan, of trusted partner that the AI needs to be, well, the human being representing that AI needs to be that trusted partner of that business unit before they can transfer that trust into this AI model that they've built. So that, you know, organizations that don't have an analytics team that is either embedded in hard line, dotted line into business units, that understands their role in the value chain, that understands how they contribute to the company's go-to-market and profitability, and can influence the leaders of those business units. Again, that's another disadvantage for AI, because you've got to earn that human trust before you can earn, you know, the human intelligence trust before you can earn the artificial intelligence trust.
Yeah. And I think what also might be helpful for a lot of people, or at least I've seen it to be helpful, is partnering with finance, because mm-hmm. to your point, there might be things you don't see. So when you think about, I think it's kind of lazy in a way to just think about efficiency, because that's a first order impact. Like, if we were to take your example about supply chain and that person, you know, we could calculate how much less time they spend searching for tickets or documents. Like, that's the first order impact that we could calculate. But what's the second, third, fourth order impact that actually paint the bigger picture that you're talking about, which is we can give our customers a heads up, which will then do XYZ, which will then help us in these ways. And so I think that's a harder exercise to do, because people don't always see what those, you know, ripple effects will be, and they don't know how to quantify it, and they don't know how the company thinks about it strategically. So to your point, like, it's a hard exercise to kind of paint that roadmap and that vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I work with, you know, analytics and AI and data teams at our customers, and we're framing up the value of different approaches and ideas, and they get stuck on efficiency, I call a timeout and I said, look, we've got to get this to a point where, you know, we're on Shark Tank. we're in a venture capital conference room in Silicon Valley, right? And we've got to convince them that this is worth an investment in. That's what we're doing. And you just think about what one of the, you know, Shark Tank people would say if you come in and say it's going to save every procurement rep 4 hours a week. They're going to say, so what, right? So let's start with that efficiency and think about, to your point, Reagan, what are the second, third, fourth order impacts? And then what could these procurement experts be doing to unlock new value once they're more efficient and they're not wading through, you know, contract details to find alternate suppliers? And so, again, it's kind of, you know, it is that like five whys, like why do we want to be more efficient, right? Just keep at that why until you get to something that, you know, I call it a Sharpie marker between this, you know, AI solution data product to an entry on a financial statement, right? We want your CFO, your CEO, your COO talking about this on an earnings call. That's the level of vision and audacity that organizations really need to pursue.
Yeah, this is why I fell in love with the AI field so long ago, because I was like, oh, not only is this really cool because we're kind of like reverse engineering people's brains and how they work and trying to get computers to do it, but also this is actually forcing fundamental transformation for companies. It's not just like a fun AI fad, you know, it's forcing actual shifts in the way companies think about what they're building, how they're building it, how their workforce is engaging with each other. And I think that it could have a massive impact if it's thought about that way, which unfortunately a lot of people are pretty, you know, narrow-minded in the way they're thinking about these types of solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still, if you think about, you know, software design and everything that has been up to this point, it is to automate an existing business process to make it more efficient and predictable, right? And if you take that same thinking to AI, then you're just going to be nibbling on the edges of the margin. You know, you're not going to unlock those, you know, billions and trillions of dollars that Bain and McKinsey and BCG are telling organizations they can get to. It does require that stepping back and saying, how do we create loyal, satisfied customers? How do we create value for our shareholders and investors? How do we create an engaging, enjoyable work environment for our team members? How do we operate responsibly in the communities that we're in? And then how can we use AI to unleash new ways of doing that aren't necessarily grounded in what we've always done?
I think you made, even before we started recording, a brilliant point around the mental model of how organizations treat kind of AI like an employee. So like the decisions you're trusting with that AI employee, monitoring their decisions and intervening if things go awry inherently. Just want to bring that up because I think that's such a brilliant kind of difference in how a lot of teams are thinking about it today. And I was hoping you can kind of expand on that for our listeners too, because I think it's important to think about augmentation of decision-making today with a lot of these AI solutions.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, back to the AI as a technology or a data analytics capability, right? People get hung up on the predictiveness of the model and the breadth of the data that was used to train it, and a lot of the analytic mechanics that senior leaders don't care about generally. And if they do care, oftentimes they don't really understand it perhaps as deeply as you might want. So the way I've been talking to some organizations about it is think about a job description for that AI agent, right? What is their purpose, right? What decisions can they make on their own? What decisions need to be supervised, i.e. human in the loop? What decisions are out of bounds and you want to prevent them from making? How do you monitor their work and the quality of those decisions? think about you put educational and training requirements in your job descriptions, right? What sort of training data is appropriate for this model, right? What are some of the aspects of that are needed of a, let's say, a large language model you're using, right? So if you would put in a human job description that they need, you know, deep understanding of financial markets, then, you know, a generalized large language model is going to be inappropriate for that. So thinking about how a business leader can communicate those needs in a way, and then having the data and analytics teams translate that into, you know, model design specs, the test plan for that model. And I believe that this will also help accelerate some of the risk management concerns, because you are clarifying where are the guardrails for this model when it comes to decision making. How are you going to monitor that in a way that the executives can understand and buy into, perhaps at an earlier stage before you've gone out and built something that may or may not do that?
Excellent point. I wish we had more time, Kathy, but with that, we're going to have to wrap today's episode. Kathy Kuntz, thank you so much for your time today. If folks want to get in touch with you, what's the best way? LinkedIn, email, yeah. We can link it in the description.
Yeah, LinkedIn is always great. I'm out there and always looking to engage with folks that, like I say, I can talk data analytics and AI longer than most people want to listen. So put me to the test.
You covered a lot in just the past 30 minutes that we've had with you. So thank you again, Kathy, for your time. It was fantastic. And thank you, listeners out there, for tuning into AI or Die episode 16. You can see all of our episodes at getalignai.com and listen to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks, everybody. Have a good rest of your day. We'll talk to you later.